This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Got a whole bunch of movies to talk about this week, including Race, Risen, The Witch, Cabin Fever, Snowtime, and Lady in the Van. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, another listener question, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece I want to talk about is in regards to the box office of Deadpool. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about Deadpool's box office in a later segment when I talk about just the general box office, but let's just say that the success of Deadpool was unprecedented. Nobody was predicting it to do as well as it did. It broke a bunch of records, including the highest opening weekend for an R-rated movie ever, the highest opening weekend in February. I mean, it's a fantastic number that Deadpool had. I mean, it made its money back like in just in one weekend. I mean, we're talking Star Wars spread of numbers here. I mean, it's not going to be a $2 billion movie, but this movie's possibly going to top $300 million, and nobody was expecting it to do that. Now, after this happened, of course, everybody, and as I predicted, everybody's like, oh, people must want R-rated comic book movies. Well, let's not overanalyze this. Already, Fox has come out and teased that Wolverine 3 is going to be R-rated. And of course, Wolverine fans want to see that because Wolverine, look, he's got adamantium claws that can cut through anything. And I've heard people say, wait, where are the beheadings? Where is the bloodbath? Because they have him go on to these rampages, but even in the movies, they restrain Wolverine quite a bit, partly because in the movies, he's developed as much more of a hero than he is in the comics. In the comics, he's very conflicted, and he has the ability to just literally tear through people, and they do that a bit in the second Wolverine movie, The Wolverine, which I thought was the weakest of the bunch. I think it was even weaker than X-Men Origins Wolverine, but that was what I think comic fans were looking for more. But the success of Deadpool does not mean that all superhero movies should be R-rated. People didn't see Deadpool because it was R-rated. It wasn't that people suddenly looked at the listings and said, oh, look, R-rated superhero movie. Let's go see what that's all about. People went to go see Deadpool because it fit. Deadpool was great fun. It was an incredibly hilarious movie, action-packed, had some great moments in it. They didn't see it because it was Deadpool. People didn't see it because it was R-rated. Now, if it had got a PG-13 rating, it would have been seen as neutered because that's what the character is. The rating is irrelevant when it comes to success like this, unless it's what a movie should be. If you remake Saw and it gets PG-13, people are going to be like, whoa, what's this, a PG-13 Saw? You know, so sometimes ratings matter, but it's not that people go see movies based on the ratings. But even as well as Deadpool can do, it's not going to top movies like The Avengers or Iron Man 3. R-rated comics and graphic novels have been around and have been a big thing since the 80s. I remember reading them when I was in high school and college. But DC still had mainstream Superman and Batman comics, even though it had The Killing Joke, which is essentially an R-rated comic. They still had mainstream Batman titles. And Marvel still had mainstream X-Men and Spider-Man comics. Not everything has to be beautiful stories for ugly children. Kudos to anyone who recognizes that title from the late 80s to early 90s. Next piece of news I want to talk about is Blade Runner 2 got an opening weekend announced, and it's going to be coming out on Martin Luther King Day in 2018. And people kind of went nuts because they're like, wait, isn't January a dumping ground? Well, it traditionally has been, but it kind of depends on the type of movie that comes out. And especially this year and last year, Hollywood has really been toying with expanding the January timeframe. And including the fact that everyone's going to be running away from Star Wars at Christmas now. Because Star Wars has now locked down the Christmas blockbuster frame. And unless you're counter-programming or offering something different, nobody wants to go up against that. No movie that's a science fiction sequel to an 80s movie is going to want to go up against Star Wars because it's kind of drawn from the same bucket here. So January is a more safe bet than right at the holidays. And even for something like Blade Runner 2 as well, the sort of more adult-oriented or grown-up movies. You know, yeah, you get Ride Along that did well, but stuff like Lone Survivor and American Sniper and The Revenant have had great success in January. So why not Blade Runner 2? Couple more real quick things in terms of development news. Apparently, the Transformer series is going to be spinning off a Bumblebee episode. That's, of course, the car that belonged to Shia LaBeouf's character. And I'm okay with it as long as Michael Bay's not directing. And in fact, I welcome this because Michael Bay has been drawn back into and trapped back into the Transformers franchise and isn't letting anybody else take a shot at it. I'd like to see what some other director can do. Could he make something that doesn't have Michael Bay's fingerprints all over it? I actually think that Michael Bay is afraid to let anyone take care of it because as successful as those movies have been, I think he's afraid to be into this franchise what Christopher Columbus was to the Harry Potter franchise, where everyone was like, oh, those first two movies were really good, well, until Alfonso Cuarón came along and showed him how to really do one. And maybe some director is going to come by and show it through this Bumblebee movie that this is actually how you make a Transformers movie that isn't stupid. So I'm all for it. Now, the other piece of development news is Shane Black, and he's working with production partner Fred Decker, who did the Monster Squad back in the 80s. They have teamed up for the Predator reboot. And I think that's great. Because Shane Black was actually in the first Predator. Most people don't realize that until he got older and started directing other movies. And he did Iron Man 3. And now in the first image that they've released, it's sort of like a teaser poster, ghostly picture of the Predator in the traditional style, not like the beefed up Predators from the previous films. But then it has the line, you'll never see him coming, which I think's hilarious because it connects to the line that the fake Mandarin said, Tony Slattery, played by Ben Kingsley, in the Shane Black directed Iron Man 3, where he says, you'll never see me coming. And I'm wondering what that means. I'm wondering if he's got something up his sleeve on this one that's going to throw a lot of people for a loop. I'm all for Shane Black doing a Predator movie because he's at least got the experience and ties to the franchise. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is The Boss, which opens on April 8th, stars Melissa McCarthy.
We are back with Michelle Darnell, the richest woman in America.
You're under arrest for insider trading.
You're bankrupt. All your accounts have been frozen.
Claire, get me a new lawyer.
You don't have any money, you stupid ginger.
Michelle, you need to get off the couch.
Take Rachel to her dandelions meeting.
Our troop came in with $189,000.
This is my way back. We are going to start a brownie empire.
I will say that this at least looks better than most of what she has put out because it's slightly different than what you've seen before. It's not just a rehash of her character from Bridesmaids, which is essentially what happened with stuff like Tammy and The Heat. The only thing that really bothers me about this is directed by her husband, Ben Falcone. He directed Tammy, which is by far the worst Melissa McCarthy movie that has ever come out. Maybe this one's going to be more funny because I think he was trying to be a little more poignant in Tammy and it just didn't work. I don't know. We'll see. I liked Spy, which kind of surprised me. So hopefully The Boss is okay. The next one I want to talk about is The Purge, Election Year, opening on July 1st.
The Purge targets the poor and the innocent.
The Sanders are going to win, and she's going to make real changes, too.
It is a night that is defining our country.
It's time to do something about that, Senator.
The Purge has to come to an end.
You take a lot of risks, Senator.
I have to. I was the only one in my family to survive.
Someone betrayed us.
This is not a drill.
Now, I was not a big fan of the first two Purge movies. I thought the first one was okay as sort of like this intimate horror movie, essentially. But I really thought the Purge Anarchy was terrible. This one looks interesting simply because I think it's taking a point to examine the greater issues around the Purge. And I do give him a little bit of credit for releasing it a couple months before the election. I mean, it's totally taking advantage in terms of the timing. I think it's a brilliant move in the marketing department. Just as ironically, I ended up getting my review copy of the Blu-ray of The Purge, and I ended up watching it on the day the government shut down. So these movies, they think they're very smart. They're not really, but they at least are hitting on certain points that will make them national conversations, I guess. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Race and Risen. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Oh, yeah.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews. The first one I want to hit is Race. This biopic examines the career of track legend Jesse Owens and his competition in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin.
Who do we have here?
I'm Jesse Owens.
You're a natural. I don't trust naturals. I will say, you can run. Boy, oh boy, you can jump. What I want to know is, can you win?
See what we got here.
Jesse Owens has a new world record.
You want to win a gold medal?
Sure. You want to do it in Berlin?
Mr. Owens, how can you justify taking part in Germany when there's so much discrimination here at home?
Now, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. I still live here, actually. And Columbus and Cleveland, I hold very dear to my heart. They have a lot of personal ties to me. And this is where Jesse Owens from. He's from Cleveland, went to Ohio State University here in Columbus, Ohio, became a huge legend back in the 30s with what he did and what he accomplished, not just on the field, in track and field, in the collegiate circuit, but also what he did as an Olympian and going to Berlin and doing so well in the Olympics, you know, much to the chagrin of a certain German dictator who was not too happy to see somebody of color beat his master race. Now, being from Columbus, Ohio, and actually when I was in sixth grade, I had a teacher. She was a very fiery, opinionated African-American woman. And I believe she was actually related somehow along the way to Jesse Owens. And so she took it very seriously. So we spent a lot of time learning about Black history when I was in sixth grade. And she made a huge point to teach us about Jesse Owens and what it meant for him to win, not just, like I said, in the collegiate circuit, but in the Olympics. So I learned a little bit about Jesse Owens, a little bit more than maybe your average person who was going to school in Columbus, Ohio at the time. So this is nothing new. I knew all this information. I knew the fact that Hitler walked out and Hitler was not happy. But, you know, that happened in 1936. So, you know, that was 80 years ago. This is not something that is necessarily as common knowledge now to everybody in Ohio as it was back then and even outside of Ohio. So it's nice to see a movie bringing back something very admirable and bringing back an athlete to hold up high. It's good to see that happen. Now, as a biopic goes, it works. I mean, it's partly produced by the Jesse Owens Foundation, which can be a little bit dicey because you get a somewhat overly reverent portrayal of the main character. Nothing against Jesse Owens, but everybody has their flaws. And there's this one little sliver of flaw that they throw in the movie to kind of make him a little more real and human. But other than that, he's kind of put on this pedestal. And that harms the biopic a bit because then it becomes less about him and more about his legend. And I think that's fine if that's what you want to achieve. And I imagine that that's what the foundation wants to achieve. But it really doesn't get into the nitty gritty of who Jesse Owens was. That's not what this movie's about. This movie's about the Olympics and what it meant for the greater picture and what it meant for America. Not just the Olympic Committee saying whether or not America was going to boycott it, but also whether or not Jesse Owens was going to boycott it in multiple stages along the way. And you kind of forget that that's actually what happened. There were many times that he had a chance to step down. And what's interesting about the movie is you know what happens at the end. You know he does extremely well, and you know that it was the best thing to do to go to the Olympics to really show it up to Hitler and the Nazis. But at the time, you didn't know if he was going to win. He may not have won. He may have choked. Who knows? So it was a gamble, and it pays off. But the movie itself is more really about the politics of the day and less about specifically looking at the twists and turns and ups and downs in Owen's life. So it's less about Owens and more about the race in general. And of course, it dovetails into the similarities between oppression in Germany and oppression of African Americans in particular in America, especially in the 1930s. I think there's some differences, and they draw too many parallels at times because, you know, there's a huge difference between how the Jews were treated in the Holocaust and how African Americans were treated in the pre-civil rights movement. And there's some similarities, but you know, they almost draw too many parallels at times for my taste. Now, what's interesting about it is two things. One thing is that Jason Sudeikis is giving Jason Sudeikis is taking on a dramatic role, which is different for him. Now, he did Tumble Down, which came out last week, which is him edging away from just broad comedies and into something a little more specific. And I think he does a fine job. He still is a little bit cheesy as a dramatic actor. But it's also, I think, kind of interesting to watch from an OSU perspective. And the football players on the football team are a bunch of racists. They're not portrayed in the highest light, which is odd because in Ohio, you're pretty much a god among men if you're a football player at the Ohio State University. The other thing that's interesting is I found these movies of discrimination of black people not being allowed to play sports just so ludicrous in today's world, because you're like, well, some of the biggest sports heroes are people of color. Not just, you know, black people, but, you know, you have Hispanics in various roles. You have Asians in there. So the idea of having a completely white sports league is ridiculous in today's concept, but it really, you know, 80 years ago was when this took place. So there was, and that was at the thick of it, of not even beginning to integrate something like football at OSU. Anyways, ultimately, I think Race is a decent movie. It's worth seeing, especially if you want to honor Jesse Owens and learn a little bit more about, not necessarily him, but the impact he had on the world. So Race kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Risen. The story of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ are told from the point of view of a Roman tribune who is tasked with finding the body of Jesus.
The Nazarene city'd rise again after 3 days. We will lose peace and order if it's true.
Will the people believe it?
The weak will.
There will be no other gods. The body has vanished.
His tomb is empty.
Already there, proclaiming him risen from death.
The Emperor cannot arrive to unrest. We must find a body.
Oh, no!
Combed the city for bodies dead in the last week.
Dig them up.
Now, this movie is a little early for Easter, but it's, I think, worth checking out. And here's why. We have seen the story of Jesus and the crucifixion and the resurrection, hundreds of times on TV and on movies, and we've read it in books, and we've read it in the Bible, and we've gone to Sunday school. Even if you're an atheist, you can't escape this story. And this is a different perspective on it. It is something that we don't see all the time. That's what I found interesting. Because, you know, like when Son of God came out a couple years ago, there was just a boring movie because it just went through all the motions. It was basically a one-to-one tale of what you read in these little workbooks in Sunday school. There's nothing unique and original or different or really even, you know, no pun intended, revealing about it. There weren't any great revelations from that movie. What I liked about this one was it takes it from a contemporary perspective of the day, you know, because as a Roman, literally happening before his eyes, but it shows it from the perspective of before this becomes history, before this changed the world. And the most interesting parts is watching this character and the changes he goes through. That's what I liked about it. Yeah, I mean, you want to see a story about Jesus coming back from the dead? You can see, there's tons of them out there. You want to see a story about a Roman soldier trying to reconcile all this? Not a whole lot of those. Jesus is in this movie, but he's a secondary character. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a unique perspective and something different, which kind of surprised me because I was kind of rolling my eyes waiting for this one to be like another TV movie, like Son of God. But it's not. It's actually worth checking out. So I'm going to say Risen kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Witch, Snow Time, and The Lady in the Van. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies, rolling through the movie reviews. Let's hit three of them in this segment. There's a bunch of interesting stuff that's opening smaller and on demand that are worth talking about. Anyways, The Witch is the first one I want to talk about. In 1630s New England, a family moves away from the fort only to find themselves the target of a witch in the woods.
Black Philip Sif, you are wicked.
Does he really speak to thee?
This wilderness will not consume us.
You've cursed this family.
This is witchcraft.
She placed a curse on me.
Your reign of evil.
It's not safe. Not with them.
This was a big splash at Sundance, and it's won a bunch of notoriety at film festivals. And it's not your typical horror movie. This is not something that teenagers and college students are going to go see and giggle at and hoop and holler at. This is a much more somber, grown-up, more articulate movie in a weird way. Now, the reason I say that is because the language, the dialogue that's used, they don't use contemporary dialogue. They use 1630s dialogue. The language has changed considerably in the last 400 years. And the reason they did that, I think, not just for the authenticity feel to the movie, but they did that because a lot of the lines in the dialogue and phrases and things that happen are taken from original documents and original accounts of stuff that has happened back in that time. Now, this is not saying that the witches are real and witches were running around the woods stealing babies back then. It's just that this is what sort of that hype was part of, and that's what people were thinking, and that's what people were suggesting. And then these things that happened, these strange occurrences, they were tying it to them, and it may have been coincidence and it may have been something else. The point being is this is how the settlers at the time saw things. And so you really get to look at it through their eyes. It's a very slow-paced, somber movie. And it's not always an easy watch simply because it's deliberate and it takes its time. But boy, is it atmospheric. It's creepy and it can be very scary at times if you let yourself get into it. You know, there's always that debate in horror movies where people go, well, that movie didn't scare me. I thought it was stupid. I saw through it all the time. I'm not saying it's going to scare everybody. I'm just saying that let yourself get involved in the atmosphere of the movie and it can be pretty chilling. Especially if you put yourself in that situation and say, hey, because the main story is about this girl and she's a teenager in the family, you know, without any sort of knowledge of the outside world or history or anything like that, put yourself as a 15-year-old girl in 1630 in the middle of the woods, it's going to be a different story. So, I mean, I think it's a really well-done movie that plays with thrills and scares and suspicion and paranoia and religion and belief and whether or not these things are true and what people can read into it and how much is real and how much is sort of your mind doing things. It plays off certain conventions of fairy tales in a very unique way. It's completely worth seeing. Like I said, it may not be the most accessible movie to the mainstream audience, and that's okay. Not everything needs to be. But it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you're into horror movies and you want to see something that takes a different approach. So I'm going to have to say that The Witch totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Snow Time. A group of kids on winter break go to war with each other, defending a fort until school starts again.
Report, soldier. What do you see?
Big fort, General?
Okay, first rule, we fight during daylight hours, never at night. Second rule, enemies never talk to each other. Then, whichever army has the fort wins.
Uh-oh, we're about to get clobbered.
Fire! You want to fight? You got one, buddy. Nobody wants to fight. Sure they do. It's fun.
Charge! This is a film that is independently produced, and it's a CGI movie. And it is done in Canada. It's getting a limited release in the U.S. It's actually showing up in theaters a lot of places. You can catch this in theaters throughout the weekend. But if you don't get a chance to see it there, you can always check it out on demand. It's one of those platform releases that's doing theatrical and on demand at the same time. And that's kind of cool because it gives people who are in an area where it's not opening a chance to actually see it if you're interested. Now, this movie is not terribly subtle. It's very clear that they're making war analogies with these kids going to war over a fort. And this is meant to show the silliness of war and the costs of war. And at times, particularly one time, it does, in my opinion, kind of go a little bit too far with what it's trying to do, but then it pulls its punch. It's just, it's not 100% satisfying. And when it's just a story about kids being kids and their interaction, I actually found it somewhat compelling and cute. However, when it's trying to make a message, which is essentially through the whole movie, but when it gets heavy-handed in that course, that's when I'm starting to say, well, you're really simplifying the politics and the complexity of war by just distilling it down to these kids have snowballs and these kids have other snowballs. So I think it's something that you can show your kids and have an interesting discussion about war and wartime and what it means and why people would go through this sacrifice. It's not just an action movie and people can really get hurt. So it can be a discussion piece or it can just be a fun thing that kids can watch. It's the kind of thing you watch on a snow day. It works. So ultimately, while it gets heavy-handed and has its issues, Snowtime is still cute, and I think it'd make a fun watch, especially on a snow day. So I'm going to say Snowtime kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up this segment of reviews with The Lady in the Van. Maggie Smith stars in this true story of a homeless woman who forms a special bond with a London playwright whose flat she chooses as a place where she can permanently park her van.
I need a push for the van. I'm a sick woman looking for a last resting place.
Three of ambulances in the war, apparently, and a nun once.
A nun?
In the convent up the street.
I won a prize for painting.
But it's all lumps, you have to mix it.
I have mixed it, only I got some Madeira cake in it.
Just till you sort yourself out.
Put the van in your drive? That never occurred to me.
This was an award contender, Maggie Smith. I think she got a Golden Globe nomination for this. It's a charming little movie. Oddly enough, it is this weird curtain call of Harry Potter and Doctor Who actors. Because you have this person from Doctor Who, that person from Harry Potter. I mean, Maggie Smith's from Harry Potter. She played McGonagall. And they've got like Danny Pink from Doctor Who shows up at one point. And he's a smaller, it's a British movie. So there's a lot of BBC people going through this film. It's very British. And it relies on the viewer's knowledge of British history and British culture. And in particular, who this playwright is and what the connection of The Lady in the Van is. I'm not going to give anything away. I mean, the playwright is Alan Bennett, who I'm not familiar with, but apparently he was a British playwright back in the 70s and well-respected. But it's really more of those charming interactions. It's not a groundbreaking movie. It doesn't deal with any giant issues. It doesn't even deal with homelessness as a giant issue. It's just, that's kind of her lot in life, and that's where she has ended up. It's more about just this odd little relationship and this somewhat respectful relationship between the two of them. And it's also told in a somewhat surreal way because the playwright kind of sees himself interacting with her. So he shows up twice. At first you think it's twins, but it's really just him interacting with his subconscious. So it does have this weird sort of surreal presentation to it. But in the end, it's just this sweet little story of a woman who's kind of got lost in time and how she relates to the people around her and how the people may not want her around, but are too polite to tell her to leave. It's a sweet movie. It's a movie you can watch with your mother, especially if she loves PBS stuff. But very well acted, charming performances by Maggie Smith. So I'm going to have to say Lady in the Van kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to review my final movie, the remake of Cabin Fever, answer a listener question, and talk about the box office and the home cinema roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Finishing up the show, we've got one more review to talk about. A little bit of a listener question and box office and, of course, DVD and home cinema selections. But let's jump into the last review, and that is Cabin Fever, the remake. Only 13 short years after Eli Roth's original film hit theaters, we get a remake about a group of college students on a trip to a remote cabin to face the outbreak of a flesh-eating virus.
It looks like you guys were having some kind of party last night.
She's sick. I'm not dying like that.
What are we dying?
I don't want to infect everyone.
No, any one of you could have it.
Them kids got disease. If cattle get sick, you gotta kill it before it spreads the rest of the herd.
I loved the original Cabin Fever. It put Eli Roth on the map, more so than Hostel, because it really brought him to a national attention because it was such a bizarre movie. And the reason I love the original film is because it took the Cabin in the Woods motif before it was sent up by Drew Goddard and Joss Whedon in 2012. It took that Cabin in the Woods story and kind of turned it on its ear. It was no longer about a monster or, like, you know, the most quintessential Cabin in the Woods story is The Evil Dead. And it took that sort of Evil Dead, but instead of making it this supernatural element, it made it a real thing. And flesh-eating bacteria at the time was making news, and it was a really creepy thing. And it became the slasher of the day, meaning it was something that could kill you. But it was very real. And I thought it was a unique perspective. And it was it used a lot of double entendre in sort of like the story, and not just the fever of being the insanity of being locked up by yourself, but also the fever from being sick. There's a lot of neat stuff in that movie, and I thought it was fantastic and grisly and terrifying in a lot of ways. Fast forward 13 years, and I was curious to see this movie because I didn't realize they were making it. I was like, really? They remade this movie? Isn't this movie like 10 years old? But they did. And while there are some slight differences to it, it's essentially just a almost shot-for-shot remake in a lot of ways. And when it deviates from the original is when I think it's lessened. There's a rather grisly scene that features Jordan Ladd, who, by the way, favorited a tweet of mine where I'm like, why are they remaking this movie? I guess she was kind of falling on the same side with me of why bother. But there's a scene in the original where Jordan Ladd is very grisly. It involves a dog. And the scene in this movie that parallels it is just not nearly as effective. There's the scene that involves a flashback in the original with Eli Roth's himself having a cameo in it. And it's a bit cheesy and corny and weird, but they don't use it to the same effect in this movie. So whenever, kind of like when they remade Psycho, even though I'm not putting the original Cabin Fever on the same level as Psycho, but in Psycho, every choice that they made in the remake of Psycho made the movie less of an effective movie. And it's kind of the same way with this one. Every time they've had it, they either just reshoot the scene, and then at that point, why bother? Because, I mean, there's no advances that required this to happen. There's really no, you know, there's no makeup effects that are newer. There's no digital effects that can really make this movie better. anytime they reshot it, it just feels like a cheap remake. But when they deviate from the original story, it's not as good of a decision. While I guess if you have never seen the original, I guess this one could work, but I really think the original's superior, and this one kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to jump into this listener question here. It comes from our good friend, Red State Gabe. And I'm answering it after the Cabin Fever review for a very specific reason, but let me just read his question. I was just rewatching Kick-Ass, and I noticed they used the same score at times from 28 Weeks Later, a movie that came out 3 years prior. I'm a huge fan of film scores, so I recognized it right away, and I was upset it wasn't a variation, but the exact same track from another movie. Upon research, I noticed the full 28 Weeks Later score was by John Murphy, and he got fourth credit in the Kick-Ass music. Did they just not want to do their own score, purchase the rights, and give them credit? And if so, how often does this happen? Well, it happens a lot, actually. And it's not, they're not ripping it off. They're not even stealing it. Probably the reason John Murphy got the fourth credit in the Kick-Ass score listing is because he probably did the fourth amount of work. You know, you generally, it's weighted by whoever does the most of the scoring. And he probably only did a handful of tracks. I mean, there's a lot of things that they use for, they use a thing from, I think it was Danny Elfman in the Kick-Ass score because he's mentioned in the comic book. So there's a little, there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff happening. This isn't them stealing this. This isn't Skeet stealing at all. They did purchase the rights. They couldn't have used it without purchasing the rights. It's just they give credit where credit's due in the whole of the score. And if it was just one scene, you're going to get lower in the credits. A great example is, if you watch trailers, you hear the music from Aliens. I think it's James Horner's score of Aliens. You hear that all the time, especially in the 90s. You heard the Aliens, and it's the scene where Ridley's driving the tank. And you hear that score in all these trailers in the 90s. They just reuse them. They just purchase the rights. Why create new music if the music's already out there? And a lot of times they use these things if it's meant to evoke some sort of either an inside reference to it, or if they're trying to pay homage to another movie. Cabin Fever is a great example. The beginning of Cabin Fever, the remake, they play The Shining music. And that's very deliberate. I mean, it doesn't fit the rest of the score at all, but it's because it's this car driving out to the middle of nowhere. I mean, in a way, The Shining is one of the most monumental Cabin in the Woods movies ever made, because It's a resort, but it is a cabin in the woods in the middle of nowhere. And I think that's kind of what they were going for. Another thing, in using Aliens as an example, in the beginning of Aliens, when Ridley's ship is drifting and she's picked up by the salvage team, they're playing a clip from the original score of 2001, A Space Odyssey. This is not stealing. This is not theft. It's not ripping it off. It's using actual music that's out there, and they do this. So Martin Scorsese uses a lot of music that's out there that you don't realize is already out there. Same thing with Quentin Tarantino. I mean, Quentin Tarantino used Morricone's score, unused score, but his score for Hateful Eight, and that's completely legitimate. This isn't a bad thing. This isn't Hollywood stealing. It happens all the time, and it's all done above board. It's meant to either evoke the same feeling or pay homage or do a reference to another movie. Hope that answers your question, and we'll talk to you soon. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the box office real quick. Last year, I predicted that Deadpool was going to win with $65 million. I was way off. It made $130-some million. Over the three-day weekend, when you throw in President's Day, its total was $152 million, which is huge. To give it an idea of how huge that is, it breaks a lot of records. It's the highest opening weekend for February. It's the highest opening weekend in winter. They're not including December, because technically winter's the 21st and beyond. It's the highest opening weekend for 4 days for President's Day, for a holiday. And it's also the highest opening for an R-rated movie, besting the Matrix movies and last year's 50 Shades of Grey. And that's great. I mean, it's kudos. They did a great job with that movie, and it really clicked. Now, what do I think is going to happen this week? Well, Deadpool's going to win again, and I'm going to use the same estimate I did last week. I'm going to say $65 million. That seems fair, coming down from $150 million off a four-day weekend. The rest of the movies are going to be fighting around $10 million or less, with Race and Risen fighting in that $8 to $10 million, maybe $11 million if they're lucky. And then The Witch is going to come much lower than that. I think it's in fewer theaters, like 2,000 or less. But The Witch is also, it's a harder sell. It's not Paranormal Activity. It's not Saw. It's not some crappy found footage movie. It's a unique film. So I think it's going to have a little bit harder time getting the audience, partly because there's no names of any note to it, and it's a deliberate, slow-paced movie that uses dialogue from the 1600s. So as good of a movie as it is, it's going to be a little bit harder to get butts in the seat. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Nice selection of movies, some of them from Oscar contenders or would-be Oscar contenders. You've got Black Mass is out on DVD and Blu-ray this week, as is Steve Jobs, two movies with fantastic performances by the lead actors, one of whom, Michael Fassbender, was nominated for an Oscar. You also have Trumbo, which also got Bryan Cranston nominated for an Oscar. Not as good of a movie as those other two, but definitely worth seeing, if you're interested in the Hollywood blacklist. There's Labyrinth of Lies, which is the German offering for Best Foreign Film. It didn't get nominated. You also have The 33, which I didn't think was particularly that good, but that's okay. It's out there on DVD and Blu-ray. There's also the Vincent Price Collection 3 from Shout Factory, and this includes Master of the World, Tower of London, Diary of a Madman, An Evening of Edgar Allan Poe, and Cry of the Banshees. And that's what's so nice about these selections from Shout Factory. If you like Vincent Price and you've already seen the big ones like House of Wax and The Invisible Man Returns and The Fly, you can catch these more obscure movies that are lesser known but still involve a master of horror. Finally, you've got Girl Season 4 if you're interested in that. That's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Eddie the Eagle, Gods of Egypt, and Triple Nine. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.